Hey everybody, welcome to one more episode of Dark Pages Podcast. In this one, we'll be talking with the music with special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself, special guest?
Oh, I, my bad. I didn't realize that was my cue to say my name. Oh, this is off to a horrible start. My name's Ryan Eich, and I'm an idiot, apparently, and also a composer, mostly for games. Dark Souls is my favorite game of all time, and you've made a huge mistake by inviting me here to talk about the
it's
music.
Okay. I'm Justin. I'm the other host, but...
And I'm Gord, the final host.
Ryan is the one who wrote the music for this podcast.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, you're sure.
You could hear our he's been on an episode of our other podcast, Red Pages Podcast. If you want to hear all about him in that episode, you can go find that interview. But today, like Gord said, we're talking about the music of Dark Souls 1.
Got him.
Guys, what's your favorite part about this music? If you had to pick one thing about the music of Dark Souls 1, like one word.
Honestly, what would you... My favorite part is the silence.
Because
it makes it so tremendously effective when the music comes in and you go, oh shit.
Yeah, Gord, you
five gargoyles jump on you.
you totally bit my steez there because I agree. Like as a composer for games mostly, a game that doesn't have very much music in it most of the time would be appalling to me, except this is like part of what makes it so special is that you only hear it when it is ready to like kick you in the face. It's awesome.
Yeah, the game uses music, like we said, very sparingly. Most of the game is not scored.
Mm-hmm.
So when it does it, it's not always, you know, five gargoyles are going to jump on your face. Although boss battle in general is a place where there will be music. But it uses it to signal that there's something important. Whether it's a boss or like a familiar location that it's trying to convey, hey, this is important, or you've been here before. You get this a lot when... You know, probably most notably, like when you first find your way back to Firelink from some other way,
mm.
and you
so
hear
good.
The music before you see where you are.
Honestly, I know the theme to Majula better than I know Majula.
It's so good. I think, to me, this is the most... Part of what I love about the soundtrack is it's not just the music's great, it's that it's one of the most intentional uses of music in a game I've ever seen. Like, there's plenty of games where, like, the soundtrack's amazing, but it's just there because we need music. This is, like, they're being incredibly thoughtful about how they use this and when they place music, and it's something that, up to this point, I don't think I had seen, especially in AAA games.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys...
It's weird because, like, Dark Souls 1 was not a AAA game, even if Dark Souls 3 was, right? Like, Dark Souls 1 was like, well, maybe this will make some money.
Yeah, it was double.
It's really interesting how, like, it's evolved.
And it made a little...
Like,
it's been okay.
Yeah.
It's, like, really evolved in that way, in an interesting way. Like,
yeah.
I think that the success of this has brought this into AAA games.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Are you... I need a faulty excuse to use my stupid graduate degree right now. Are you guys... You guys are familiar with John Cage? Do you know who that is?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So kind of a weird artsy, 20th century composer. Wrote a lot of really bad music. But his writings on, like, thinking about music is really cool. And a lot of people know he has this famous piece called 4:33, which is 4 minutes and 33 seconds long. And it's literally silence. So many people get mad about it because, like, literally a person comes out and sits at a piano, puts the sheet music, which is blank, up on the fucking piano, and sits there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. There are movements within the piece. The person will flip the pages, like, fucking no sound. Because the idea is that the ambient noise you hear other people breathing, people coughing, cars going by outside, like the air conditioning, that's supposed to be the piece for you. And I thought this was the most pretentious, like, bullshit I'd ever heard in my life when I learned about it. But what I really love is Dark Souls is kind of a manifestation of this idea. Like, the when you're not fighting a boss, when you're not experiencing the music, the world's sounds are so important that they kind of become this almost musical soundscape for you. Like, you need every sound you can possibly hear, and music would just kind of... There's a composer saying this, like, music would just get in the way. Like, you need to be able to hear every enemy sound, you need every environmental cue you can get, and it almost kind of becomes a composition unto itself because you're listening so intently to it.
I've got a challenge for you.
Yes, please.
take all of the thuds and grunts and wire one to each of your keys on your keyboard.
That's, you're joking, I'm not joking.
Like, no, I want to hear that.
that's going to show up on Twitter probably next week. By the way, I forget, can I swear on this show? Can I be a foul mouth spicy
too,
boy?
It's too late.
I mean, I've done it.
I broke that ground.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're in. We can, yeah. I'll just mark this. We can just mark the episode as explicit in the feed.
If you'd prefer not to, I can try to watch my spicy boy language, but...
No, it's too late. We've already
the seal is broken.
Yeah, the Rubicon has been crossed. I mean,
okay, great.
Yeah, so while we're talking about musicians, you know, John Cage, we should talk about the man behind this soundtrack, Motoi Sakuraba. He was born August 5th, 1965, and has written a lot of game music over the years, and I think anime music too, although
yep.
I'm less familiar with that. You may know him because he is the primary composer, I believe, on a lot of the Tales of games.
Yeah.
Like Tales of
Vesperia. Because of Symphonia, and yeah, he's done a lot of that. He also did Smash Bros. For 3DS and Wii U, which has...
Yeah, well, he arranged some of his own pieces for that.
Yeah, he's...
Because he works very closely, not just with Namco, but with Camelot Software Planning, who does all of the Mario Tennis games.
Which are fucking so great. Tennis is the worst sport by far, and those games are so fucking good.
I don't know. Golf and is also, down there. Cricket.
Cricket sucks.
They do golf. They do Mario Golf too. But he also did Golden Sun. That RPG
series. Oh my god, that's right.
But I think you can hear a lot of similarity. I think the instrumentation that he chooses. Between these, I mean, I wouldn't say that the music in Golden Sun is like very similar melodically.
I definitely found it
the
haunting.
Music of Dark Souls, but I think that. Yeah, what were you gonna say, Ryan?
I was just agreeing with you that like it's not very similar to Dark Souls music at all. I think in Golden Sun, but he does such a good job of looking at a game and be like, what will make the music be distinguished? What will make it be a singular entity that this game could not do without, and then he just does that. And it's insane that, like, he's done so many different projects that all sound so wildly diverse from each other, and they're all
perfect. But I think that you can pick out a through line.
Yes.
And I think that this is obvious, like, in... I'm gonna talk about the open... Like, on the title screen of Dark Souls 1, there's that song called Souls of Fire. Mm-hmm. And this is a really weird piece. I think it's in 9-4, or maybe it's like 18-8. It's in this really weird time signature. And there is a portion of this, I don't have the timestamp for it, but comes in midway through where there's a really sort of dramatic oral shift. And it sounds very similar to something like you get in a Golden Sun.
Yeah.
Because you get this, what feels to me very much like his signature instrumentation of sort of like bells, strings, synth, and a weird chorus.
That That's his jam. He loves the like wavering, warbling chorus, and he loves to change time signatures. I also want to point out, if you've ever read, this guy rules, because if you've ever read an interview with him, he's the worst interviewee on the face of the earth. Like, people will be like, so how'd you get started in music? And literally he'll be like, I was in a band. And they'll be like, well,
yeah, he was in a band. Yeah. he was in he was signed to a record label.
Yeah.
It was they had a studio album. The band was called Deja Vu.
And he left that for video game music, which is an incredible career move.
I feel like the Nier guy might top that for worst interviewee. So this is like 15 minutes of curled up on the floor crying.
I mean, at least you get...
Yeah, I tried to find some interviews with him, but they were all in Japanese, so I'm glad that you were able to track one down, because I do not speak that language.
It could, to be fair, it could be the language barrier, but he doesn't, like, extrapolate on anything. People will be like, well, what research did you do for the Dark Souls soundtrack? Like, what was your research like? And he was like, I did no research. And that's the extent of his answer, and it's like, cool. Good talking to you, Moto. I love it.
Yeah, so I think that album, I did not seek out this album to listen to as preparation. I just looked up what the title was. But the title of that album that he put out when he was in that band, it was Baroque in the Future.
Fuck yeah.
Which I think is actually like really sort of a good signal for his entire style, even in these games.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like a weird prog rock electro-baroque
thing. We'll get into it when we get to Ornstein and Smo and a couple others, but I definitely noticed like a heavy baroque through line through a lot of these, which is you don't hear it in games that aren't set in that period very often, and I really dig it here.
Yeah, and I think it makes sense, because how many sequences in these games take place in churches? Like, it's just the perfect fit. That's the sort of music he writes anyway. But, like, he found a game that takes place, like, 70% inside
of
various churches.
Like, he was made for this. He was like, oh, yeah, I can write a toccata every other piece? Fuck yeah. Like, this was his, like, he was made to do this.
So if you have specific pieces you wanted to call out, why don't you tell us about them? Why don't we start talking about those?
I feel like it makes sense to start with the prologue, the piece you hear during the opening cutscene. What I really like about it is it's very kind of classical in nature, in that like when you write a prelude to a symphony, you want it to kind of be like a mishmash of the things you're about to hear. You want it to be a good introduction. And like this is totally that. Like there are like a lot of the music in Dark Souls is atonal, which means it doesn't conform to a typical key, like 99.9% of all music we hear every day in anything. You know, a lot of Dark Souls music is atonal, so it kind of doesn't stick to things that our ears can really, like, understand based on the music we hear all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in this prologue, during the cutscene, you hear a lot of the piece is atonal, or at least kind of flirts with atonality. Like, it's very weird sounding. It doesn't really stick to a home base that your ear can graft onto. But then there are sections of it that do latch onto a specific key, which is something that a lot of the pieces in this game do. It goes from being very, very subtle and minute, just kind of a couple plucked strings and like a kind of like violin bed, and that's it. And then it goes to the full like booming like choir and like pounding drums. And it kind of runs the gamut of all the music you're going to hear throughout the game. And I really like that. Like, I love that they kind of covered the ground that you're going to hear throughout this entire experience.
Even like in microcosm, a little bit of that atonality shows up even in like one of the most, I would say, melodic pieces in the game, which is Gwyn's theme, which is probably like one of the most famous themes, because that shows up like that is that the only piece that gets quoted in a future game? Are there any other tracks that come forward in the same way?
I don't think so. It's also one of the only ones that kind of can be quoted. It's like that and Firelink and a couple others, because again, so much of the music in this game is non-melodic, which normally is not my favorite thing. That's how I write as a composer. I like music that is has a strong melody. It's something that you can hum. It's something that you could do a cover of if you're a musician. Like, that's my jam. And a lot of the music in this game is very much just like an atmosphere and like meant to like provide tension, but it doesn't really have like a hummable melody. But Gwyn's theme is one of the few that does, and so it's easy to quote it later because you can hear it and be like, oh, I remember this from before. Whereas like if you quoted the Gaping Dragon, people would be like, what the hell is that? Like,
yeah. Right, but even in Gwyn's theme, I was listening to it earlier during prep, and I was listening to the whole thing, and at about the 2 minute mark in that track, it just shifts really dramatically for, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds, and you get this pounding repeated chord that's entirely dissonant with the melody that's playing, and it just pounds and pounds and pounds and pounds.
Yeah, that's very much a Sakuraba thing, not just in this soundtrack, but throughout his work, where he'll just like get bored or something with what he's doing, and he'll take a break and have this weird musical interlude for like 10, 20 seconds where something kind of fucked up and repetitive happens, and then he'll go back to what he was doing. And you're just kind of left wondering, like, what? I think it's good. I love that about him, but it's like, what the hell was that? Like, you're kind of left in confusion, and I think he likes... My hunch is that he likes giving that feeling to people and making people wonder, like, what was that about? And then, like, just moving on without giving them any context.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, how much... And this is a question that I don't have the answer to. But, like, how much of the game had he seen while he was writing this? Or was he writing it based on descriptions? And how much of, like, was he trying to convey specific ideas that like thematically exist in Souls versus trying to just do his own thing?
So in the one English language interview I was able to find of his, that's the one where I got all these sweet quotes such as I was in a band, he says that he took in a lot of like the concept art and like the world building and stuff, but he was very much kind of isolated from a lot of the rest of the team when he was writing this, which makes it kind of fucking insane that it works so well. I almost wonder if it's just because Dark Souls is meant to be such a lonely feeling experience that, like, because he wasn't as connected to the rest of the team, it just kind of worked out. But, like, I didn't expect to find out that, like, yeah, he, you know, as an audio person, I can attest to this. Like, some projects, you end up kind of just in the dark a lot of the time. You're just like, I think this is right. And that was kind of where he says he was at. And it's interesting that it works so well.
Okay, that's what I would expected, because I found, as good as the music is and sort of as fitting as it is, I found it very difficult to sort of get the sort of thematic ideas that Dark Souls is trying to convey narratively out of the music in the way that, you know, sometimes you just get like, oh, they're doing some musical trick right here that speaks to some story element that's really like clever.
Yep.
And I just didn't get any of that. And I was wondering, like, did he even know what was going on?
Sometimes he did, but definitely a lot of time he was in the dark, which is fucking crazy to me. That I think you can kind of spot the pieces, like, as I was going through my notes, doing a full listen on the soundtrack before this, there are some pieces where it's like, this is good, it fits, but it's just kind of, like, baseline Dark Souls. Like, it doesn't do anything crazy. Like, this Ceaseless Discharge is kind of that way. Calamite and the DLC is kind of that way, where it's just like, this is good, but it's just like, it doesn't do anything special. And I think those, if I had to guess, those are the ones where it's like, I don't know enough about this, I'm just gonna do Dark Souls music and it will fit. Like, but there are plenty of bosses where he puts in these special touches, like Artorias and Pinwheel and Quelag, however I still don't know how to fucking say that boss's name, where he puts in these special touches where it's like, okay, he clearly was more involved with this one because he gets it. Like, he's doing musical things that speak to this character. And some tracks in the game do that, and some don't. And so I think, like, it's kind of a clear marker of, like, where he was more in the know where he wasn't.
Gord, do you have any specific pieces that you want to call out?
I really like Gwyn's theme because it, again, the way that the boss music subverts your, it signals to you that something is different. The Gwyn theme is different from all the other boss music because it's this sort of sorrowful melody instead of being, you know, all the trumpets and horns.
It's fucking,
it's subdued instead of bombastic.
It's fucking perfect. Like this to me, like it's not my favorite track in a video game, but it's my favorite, like, use of a track because every single other boss, you get a cutscene, you get a big bombastic, like, pile of horns and, like, screaming choirs and stuff. And it's, it gets you pumped up to fight. But my favorite thing about, you know, making music for media is when the music isn't just there because we need music. It's we get to tell a story. The music gets to be a part of the storytelling. And that's what this is. Like, you get to Gwyn and he's, you know, he built up throughout the mythology as, like, he's a god, literally. And when you get there, he's just a sad, slightly crazy old man. Like, he's he's wasted away. And the music reflects that. There's no cutscene. You just enter the room and you just hear this, like, sad piano, which is different than everything else in the soundtrack. There's almost never another track that, like, is just featuring basically solo piano and almost nothing else. And it's such a good use of, because the song completely just tells the story of, like, yeah, this guy's broken. Like, you're probably doing him a service by taking him out. And it's, I just love it.
So, yeah.
You brought up the Ornstein and Smough track. What do you think about that?
Well, A, I heard it a billion times because it's Ornstein and Smough, and, like, god damn it. But what I really like about it, hold on, I'm trying to find it in my notes here. One thing I really love about it is that it is actually, like, very, this is one of the more Baroque pieces that happens. Like, it's very much in the style of, like, court music of that era. It's very much.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
What's that? Court music. So it sounds a lot like a royal thing.
When you mean court music, like,
music, oh, okay. Music that would be played for like the royalty in, like, you know, 1700s, 1600s, okay. Bavaria.
I got you. I thought like a judge court. Music.
I was thinking.
Yeah, that also would have been rad. That also would have made a lot of sense. But no,
I was like, is this like the music in Phoenix, right?
No, from 600 AD.
Okay. All right, continue.
Excuse me.
Good.
Yeah, but there's a it's very Baroque, and it sounds like the kind of music that was written for royal patrons and was played in the royal court in that time. There's literally a part where an organ comes in and it's playing this very, like, Bach-like kind of organ cantata bit. And I love that because, you know, these two characters are meant to, you know, they're very closely tied to the royalty. They're the last stop before you get to Guinevere. And I like the idea that it's really kind of highlighting them. And in fact, when I was listening to it, like, I wasn't able to listen to it too well when I'm playing the game because I'm getting my ass just handed to me over and over. But when I listen to it outside of getting completely stomped, there are parts in it where it sounds really heroic in a way that a lot of boss battles in Dark Souls don't. They sound very dark and menacing and there's a lot going on. It's very chaotic. And this one, there are many chord progressions where it's like, this is normally the type of thing that in classical music is written for the hero character in an opera or whatever. And what I like about that is the idea that, like, they're trying to highlight, like, this is, as we all know, like, Anne Orlando is full of lies and it's a big false, you know, illusion. It's highlighting the fact that these two characters in that illusion are heroes. They're defending Guinevere from you. You're the invader, you're the monster, and they are here to stop you. Even though one of them's a big fat cannibal and that's not so great, but, like,
yeah, the other one is not even real, as they tell us in Dark Souls 3, right?
Oh my god. Let's not.
It's just Smough. It's just Smough and the empty illusion of Ornstein.
But yeah, I just love it so much. Like, it's very different than many of the other boss themes because of that fact that it very closely ties back to, you know, music of the royal court of a certain era in a way that the other tracks don't. They're just like, here's a big scary monster. And that works. But here it's just like, this is trying to put you in a place where, like, you are the invader. You don't belong here, but they do. And I love that so much. I never notice that when I'm playing because I'm using every last neuron I have to fucking survive the fight. But when listening to it solo, it's really cool.
Yeah, so I think I had the opposite opinion.
Yeah.
Not opinion. The opposite experience with Ornstein and Smo, because I beat them on my first try, so I couldn't hum that music for you if you like.
Okay. This isn't a contest, Justin.
But I just think it's interesting that, like, what I'm not saying this to be like, aha, get good. What I'm saying is, like, given how sparsely the music in this game is and how, like, reasonably they do expect players to be dying a lot on these bosses, and especially, like, people, I think most people feel that Ornstein and Smo are probably the hardest boss in this game, yep, outside of the DLC, right? That seems, yep, like an uncontroversial statement.
I agree with that in principle. I actually have a weird disease where, except for these guys, I constantly have trouble with the bosses, aside from Pinwheel, that nobody has trouble with, and all the bosses that are very difficult for everyone else, I freeze through. Like, these were
How do you feel about Pinwheel?
Like, yeah, Pinwheel, I destroyed him, but, like, the four kings, everybody's like, they're so hard, and I beat them on the first try. Bosses that people say are just, like, Ceaseless Discharge, like, oh, he's so easy, just run. I'm like, no, I'm a loser. That's not what happened.
Ceaseless Discharge ruined me. Anyway, I don't want to, like, get off on a tangent of, like, how easy or hard bosses, sure, were, but I'm saying, but my point is, like, they expect you to hear these tracks, like, these specific tracks, especially for the hard bosses, over and over and over again, right?
Yes.
And I think that part of what you're saying about, like, this drives home that, like, they're the heroes here, or, like, you're entering their space, is incredibly important, because, like I said, as somebody who, like, beat them on the first try and then just, like, got past them, and did you beat them on the first try?
You hadn't mentioned it.
No, I did not pick up on any of that stuff, and I think that, like, even listening to it on YouTube or on the soundtrack or whatever afterwards, without having the experience to go with it, you don't necessarily pick up on that stuff. Like, that's not something that I, like, really thought about even reviewing tracks.
Well, when you're...
Because it just was, yeah, like, it didn't jive with the experience I had.
When you're an all-star gamer, that's a really interesting... You know, when you're, like, a pro-level, okay, gamer who can just beat them on the first try, like, it's understandable.
Yeah, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, what is it? What's the pro gaming league that Giant Dad belongs, yeah, to?
I don't remember what you mean. But yeah, no, it's easy, man, to admit. Like, I only really discovered it this year when I kind of, for this podcast, and then earlier this year, I just went on a kind of dive on the soundtrack, and I was like, man, this is really, like, Baroque era, you know, court music. Again, this is the only time I'm ever using my stupid degree for any reason. What a treat. And it's just, like, it's such a cool idea. Like, I could be, as with many, many people do with Dark Souls, I could be reading into things that were not intended. But it stands out in the entire soundtrack as one of the only tracks where Artorias does this too. But again, that makes sense. It fits. He's a knight. It's one of the only times when they kind of adhere to this classical principle, you know, while still making it Dark Souls. It still shifts keys a lot. It still kind of gets a little atonal and gets weird. But it's one of the only times they do this, so I have to feel like it's intentional.
Well, it does take place in the biggest church in the game, so...
It's a big-ass church.
Man. Do you think that, like, people actually went to worship in these churches, or were they more, like, houses? Like, I feel like Guinevere lives there, right? Like, it's her house.
Well, she's literally too big to get through the door, so yeah, she she, that's her summer home for sure, at least.
Does she... I wonder if she's actually that big, or if it's just that big because it's an illusion.
I mean, that's true. Because this is all fake.
Her brother is, like, a normal size, right? Gwyn is a normal size.
He is.
But then, like, in Dark Souls 3, Gwyn's secret daughter is as big as that, so who even knows?
Yeah, I love Dark Souls 3 as a game, but as far as the lore goes, yeah, they really... They kind
of... They showed you a bunch of stuff that you wanted to see, right?
They're like, remember this guy? He was the blacksmith from before? He's back, baby. Better than ever. Like, cool. Why?
No. Remember this guy? He was the blacksmith in Outer Londo, and now he's dead. How do you feel about that?
How do you feel about that, asshole? Like, thanks.
It's like, man, this guy forged my weapons.
Yeah, I have an actual very serious attachment to him.
Now he got eaten by a weird slug. Man, ceaseless discharge may be called ceaseless discharge, but if anything looks like a ceaseless discharge, that's Aldrich.
Accurate. If I may, and please, you guys are the hosts, so tell me to shove it. I would love to talk about Cethascalus, because, man, he is...
No.
He is my favorite Poindexter in the world. He loves books. He loves to read. He's a loser. But also, his music is very singular in that it uses a lot of elements that are used almost nowhere else on the soundtrack. His theme has a ton of xylophone and glockenspiel in it. It's got a ton of, like, wood percussion, like wood blocks and stuff. And the entire track does all these weird, like, manic breaks where it will be doing one thing and you're kind of, like, hearing the type of music you hear during Taurus Demon and during Gaping Dragon, where it's like, okay, it's very big and bombastic and there's a choir and da-da-da. And then all of a sudden it will stop and just you'll hear a bunch of people beating on wood blocks. A xylophone freaking out, and then it'll do something else, and then it'll do something else, and it's just like, oh, I get it, this guy's insane. Like, it's it's so good. Like, it's such a good manifestation of his, like, manic, you know, obsession with immortality. Like, it really, it's so different than anything else in the boss tracks in the game. There are instruments in it that are literally never used again, as far as I can tell, and it's just, it's such a good, like, characterization of him musically, where it's like, this dude is fucking nuts. Like, all he wants is one thing, and he only just now is barely getting it, and he's still crazy from the amount of effort he put into it.
I think he was crazy,
I think he was crazy, well, yeah.
The other dragons making fun of him all the time.
Ain't even got legs.
Yeah. Yeah, they've even got that crystal stuff that makes them double immortal for some reason. They don't even need it.
Yeah, he turned a bunch of ladies into blue Squidwards, and he has cool tentacles now, so he's really growing.
I wonder how it feels, Steve.
But yeah, I just love it. I think it's such a... Again, like, there are many... I love every track on the soundtrack, but there are many tracks... on this album that are just like, this is a Dark Souls ass song, you know, the
yeah, and I think, like, not even just like a Dark Souls song, but like, this is a generic
yes
song that this in the style that this
yeah like writes. it could fit, you know, if you wanted to swap someone in, it could fit almost any boss in the game, but there are
right.
And they're still good, they're still well made, but it's just like, this is, you know, like the Centipede Demon is like, okay, you know, the most they did with that one was you know, in every documentary about insects, they will do pizzicato, which is where you pluck the strings of your violin, and you'll get this, like, gluk, 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 like, and they do that. It's super creepy. They do it every time there's a fucking spider on screen, and that is really heavily incorporated into the Centipede Demon's theme, which I love, because it's like, oh, it's a bug. What do we do? But... other than that, you know, it's good, but it's just like, this is just Dark Souls music. And I love when, you know, he goes off script and is like, I'm going to do something weird. And, like, you know, Seath's theme is definitely fits the Dark Souls model, but is just very singular. And the fact that there are instruments that are only used for him, you know, again, like, you never know for sure. I don't want to read things in where they aren't there, but I really feel like that's intentional.
This is for Centipede Demon, right?
No, this... sorry, I kind of bounced between, like...
Okay. Okay, I was like... It's like, did they use pizzicato for Centipede Demon?
No, they did use pizzicato for him, right, but they didn't use xylophone or metallophone or glockenspiel or a lot of this wood percussion that's coming in on Seath's thing. You really only hear those prominently for him, which I love.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, like, Centipede Demon as, like... If there's going to be a forgettable boss in Dark Souls, it's probably that guy.
I did forget him. Like, when I was doing the research for this episode, I was like, oh yeah, there was a Centipede Demon. Like, I literally did forget about him. Because he's...
Yeah, him and... I feel like also... I guess also Demon Fire Sage, right?
Who I literally just remembered now when you said those words out loud. Like, yeah.
Right, because he's just a recolor of Asylum Demon or... Asylum Demon 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Asylum Demon 2 Bigger and Better.
Yeah, that was a hard boss. That boss killed me more than almost any other boss in the game.
His fucking cute little Mario butt stomp like wiped my ass out so many times.
Yeah, that his shockwave is magic damage instead of physical damage, but it doesn't signal that out anyway.
Ugh. Yep. What about you guys? Do you have any other standouts? Like, I have a bunch. Like, I can keep going, but I don't want to monopolize.
Well, for me, I think that, like, the one that I probably heard the most was the Firelink Shrine.
Oh my god. It's...
I don't even know what to call that initial tone that leads you into it, that, like...
Well, that's actually what's great about it is, again, so much Dark Souls music is atonal, so it doesn't conform to a key, and that's on purpose, I think, because you're, even if you don't know much about music, like, we hear so much music every day, your ear understands certain things just intuitively, and most of the music we hear all the time every day is in a specific key of some kind, and atonal music doesn't fit to that, doesn't map on properly, so your ear kind of feels uncomfortable. And one thing I love about Firelink is it's one of the only tonal pieces on the soundtrack. You just get this nice... It's just an E minor chord, but it's a chord. Like, we know what it is.
If the tracks in this game were atonal, like, in the way that I'm familiar, like... I will listen to some 12-tone music. It's atrocious sounding.
It's bad.
Like, it's interesting. But, like, it's not even that... It's just... It's like a... It's in this, like, weird middle space.
Yeah, it's not... that's true.
Where you could, like... You think you're picking out, like, what is a melody, and then it just, like, collapses in on itself, and it's something different.
Yep.
And you're like, I don't understand anymore what's going on.
It's more like they...
It's really... Like, it's frustrating, and it makes it really hard to talk about.
Yeah, which is part of what I love about it. Like, it's... You're right. It's not true... atonal in the sense where, like, I refuse to conform to the conventions of what music in the Western world has been. Like, it in most Dark Souls pieces on the soundtrack, you can kind of find what key they are in, or at least, you know, many of them change keys, but what they start in. But then they don't abide by the rules of that key at all. And one thing I love about Firelink Shrine is it totally, for the most part, does. It's in E minor. It starts on that. And then you get a lot of, in music, what are called suspensions, which is a note that doesn't belong in the current chord that's being played. It's a little too high. But then when it drops down, your ear goes, oh, hell yeah, that's what I want. So you get this, like... you get that drop down, and your ear just goes, oh, my God, that feels so comfortable. And that's what's so great about this, is just the music communicates, like, you are safe here. This is maybe the only place where you're safe. And even then, if you're my sister, and you're playing the game for the first time, and you hit the... Crestfallen Warrior too many times in the face because you don't know what this game is, and your life is ruined because now he's mad at you and he's there every time you respawn there. It's not actually safe, but, like, it's the safest you're gonna get.
My brother did the exact same thing.
She had to start over.
He talked to Crestfallen Warrior. Yeah, that's exactly the same thing. No, he talked to the Crestfallen Warrior, got that entire, like, info lore dump, said, I don't remember any of what he just said. It was, like, just some nonsense. Talked to him again, and he won't repeat himself. He just is like, what, I told you, get going.
Yeah, get out of here.
And so he got mad at him and hit him, and then got ruined.
Yeah, and...
Over and over
And again. He's just there, like, that's where you respawn, and it's like, bye, that's like, this, he lives here, he's gonna kill you. And yeah, she's much further in the game now, she's actually in the process of her first playthrough after much prompting and yelling from me, but she had to restart her save because she salted the earth by doing that. But yeah, that's what I love about Firelink is that it is immediately like you, anybody who's played Dark Souls, when you hear that music, even if it's divorced from the game, you just, it comes up on Spotify or whatever, you immediately like, ah, like it feels comforting because you know, like this is one of the only places where you are relatively not being murdered right now.
Yeah.
And it's partially because so much of the rest of the soundtrack doesn't conform to musical conventions, you know, and this one, this track does, like, it stays within its key, like, it sounds comforting, it's, I'm not saying it's boring, but it does make progressions in music that your ear goes, that makes sense to me, and it's intentional, because, like, they want you to feel like this is safe, and then every time there's a boss battle, it's almost always like, I'm in this key, now I'm in this one, now I'm in this one, now I'm in this one, and actually, I'm in this one, but I'm not even gonna play any of the notes in the key, really, so suck it, and, like, they're doing that on purpose to throw you off, whereas Firelink is the opposite, they want you to feel safe and like you understand what this place is, and I love that so much. Like, it's still one of the best, It's not my favorite track in the game, but it's one of the most well utilized tracks because it's just so good at putting you in that place and making you feel like this is my home.
Could you compare it to the Majula theme?
Yeah, like Majula is also very similar. Majula, it's kind of the, I don't mean to make it seem like it's a repeat, but it's kind of the same trick where it's like this, there are so many tracks in this game that are going to go to weird places for your ear, whether you're musically inclined or not. And Majula specifically does not. And you got those like comforting charms.
I personally like Majula's theme a lot better, but I think it's also like more heavily melodic than the...
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
Than the the Firelink
shot. Firelink is definitely more of a music bed. Like, it has a rough melody, but it's more of like, here are just some harmonic progressions we're going to do to relax you. Mm-hmm. Whereas Majula definitely has, like, a melody you can play. And it's very different instrumentationally as well, which I appreciate. Like, it's got those really, like, charming chimes. And it's just, but it's that same trick of like, this is music that like, it's not boring, but it is familiar. You can, whether you're musically inclined or not, you can get there. And so much of the music in the game is like, I'm gonna fuck you up. Like, you don't know what you're hearing. And I love that so much. Like, I kind of miss having, I feel like 3 doesn't do that as well with their Firelink Shrine. Mm. I don't remember, honestly, it's so, I like 3, so please don't at me, but just... Firelink Shrine and 3 even have music? I literally don't remember. I've only played it the once.
So here's the thing. I don't know, remember if Firelink Shrine doesn't, but when you go back to the Dark Souls 1 Firelink Shrine in the Ringed City, they don't play that. And like, what are you doing?
It feels like right, yeah. And that's part of why, like, I won't get into it, but I don't love the Ringed City, and partially because it's like, you are missing some huge opportunities to... You spend the whole fucking game, like, shoving things from previous games in my face and being like, remember this? And then you have a chance to do something poignant, like actually bring back the Firelink Shrine music, and you don't do it. Like, that's nuts to me.
Yeah. On the other hand, I really liked the Ringed City, like, as a play thing. I liked.
Oh, it's great to play.
I liked doing that cover, and I went through it when the angels were like, "Oh, if they see you, you're dead." They have pinpoint sniper accuracy. I don't know if you played that. They patched that real fast.
Oh, okay. Because yeah. It was impossible. I never played that. That during that time, is that how it was? They would just blast you the second you were in.
Yeah. On launch, they had perfect aim, it was crazy.
That is rough.
But like, I found that really, like, I found the like crazy puzzle of how to get through the cover really entertaining. But I know that that's like a minority opinion. People really hated the beat cover shooter nature of this DLC. But thematically, it was sort of like, okay, like what are you doing here? I like seeing a bunch of old stuff, but I don't know. We don't. This is not a Dark Souls 3 podcast. We have not come to relitigate like whether Dark Souls 3 was good or not. But I think that if you have complaints about Dark Souls 3 in terms of not understanding what was good about the thematics of Dark Souls 1, those complaints may carry through musically as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But yeah, I just... I wish they had taken more, like, I feel like this will be the last thing I say about the sequels, because that's not what this episode's about, but I wish they had taken more, aside from Gwyn's theme, more opportunities to do musical callbacks, because even if it's, like, one of the more kind of less melodic themes, like many of these are, somebody would figure it out. Like, a huge facet of what Dark Souls is that, like, they just went, well, it's the internet, people will figure shit out. And that's what makes the community so fun, is you can go online and be like, how do I do this? What is this esoteric thing? And someone will have posted it. So I feel like people would have gotten it, and they just kind of, it feels like a missed opportunity to me.
Yeah, and also, like, you could say it's cheap or lazy or whatever, if that's the way you feel, but musical quotes and sort of recurring themes are a really, really easy shortcut to emotional impact in an experience.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, even if you don't, that's why I said, like, calling back to what I said at the beginning of the episode, you hear the Firelink theme before you actually make it back to Firelink. And so you instinctually get that, like, oh my gosh, I'm safe.
Yeah.
Rush before you're, you know,
before you see the bonfire.
Thinking brain, you know, you're, yeah, you didn't, as, what's his name from Red Letter Media, who does the Mr. Plinkett says, you didn't know it, but your brain did.
Yeah, exactly. And it's such a good feeling. That's one thing I love about the way the audio is used in this game is that it gives you the tell before you see it. Another thing, if I may, and again, you're the host, so tell me to stop it. If you don't want to talk
about it, go for it.
One thing I love is that many of the bosses in Dark Souls games, I think especially in this first one, are kind of no-win scenarios where, like, you're fighting someone where it's like, even if you win, you're a monster. And the way music behaves in those battles is so good. Like, for the obvious one, and I'm in danger of, like, tearing up even bringing it up, but Greywolf Sif is just the... Every time I replay this game, when I have to fight... I don't know if Sif's gender is ever actually discussed. I've always thought of her as a her, but I don't know. But either way, every time I have to play this battle, it's awful. It feels so bad. And the music knows this. The music is very different than a lot of, like, you know, again, Ceaseless Discharge, Gaping Dragon, Taurus Demon. You know, these are monsters that are in your way and they're scary. Like, this is someone who is literally kind of trying to protect you by stopping you from getting this ring that will let you go into the abyss. Like, they're doing this kind of on your and everybody's behalf. And
have you ever done the Sif fight after doing the DLC?
I have. I knew about the cutscene change, but I wanted to see it in person. And it was like, cool. Now I feel even worse. Great. Like... It's definitely just this amazing look where if you're not familiar, listeners, like, if you beat Artorias DLC first and free Sif from, like, the little protection spell, Sif remembers you and, like, kind of gives you this look when they see you of, like, I don't want to do this and I respect you, but I have to stop you. And it's just, like, it's awful. Like, it's the worst feeling to fight this boss after doing that.
You'd think that Sif would just be like, oh, obviously, they couldn't, like, go back and cut out a boss fight. Like, they weren't going to do that.
Sure.
But it is a weird, like, tonally dissonant that Sif would just be like, sorry, we got to throw it down to the death now.
It is a little weird because, like, Sif's whole thing is protecting the ring so that, you know, I love that turn of, like, oh, I'm here to guard this powerful trinket so you can't go in the abyss. But really, once you get down there, it's like, I'm here to stop people from making a horrible decision by going down there. I'm not trying to protect a treasure. But the fact that, like, dog, literal dog, when I met you before, I was in the abyss already. I've done this already. Like, I don't see the problem. Like, I can handle it. I killed the fucking king of the inky darkness already. You were there. Maybe we're cool, but, like, no.
Yeah, you... thanks for causing Dark Souls 2 out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, just think, you killed Mattis, and it ruined all of those other kingdoms all across the world as a result.
Whoops.
I think it's more that he is keeping you from collecting the Lord Souls back together and, you know...
Or, like, doesn't want the same thing to happen to you that happened to Artorias.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
But you've seen... You can look around the battlefield, and there are just hundreds of other weapons. You're not the first person.
They are all Artorias's weapons.
Are they?
No, I probably not.
Feel like that's. I feel like that's a weird statement.
So okay, Artorias had infinite carrying capacity, just like the protagonist. And when he died, Sif took all of the weapons from his inventory and threw them all around this clearing.
Those are markers. Those are grave markers.
Yeah.
So, like,
we're getting up. I was going to say, we're starting to pull up to the end of our allotted time already.
No, it went so fast.
Yeah, I know. So I wanted to say, like, are there any sort of wrap up thoughts or final things we want to say about the music of Souls 1?
I mean, if I would just like to say, I think I've stated this a couple of times, but for me, it's one of the most intentional uses of music in a game that I've ever seen. And it makes sense for Dark Souls because they're intentional about everything. That's part of what we love about it. But like, it really uses and doesn't use music in a way where like they were incredibly thoughtful about what's going to have the deepest impact, what's going to affect the story the most, what's going to put the player in this world. Like, again, and this game has a ton of music in it, but it's largely silent. And normally that would be something that would bother me, but just it puts you in the world so much more. You feel that desperation and that bleak kind of tragedy of everything because all you hear are the clink of like swords and armor and like the moans of the undead and shit. And instead of like having a soundtrack be there to remind you, this is a video game though, it only kicks in when it's really, you know, gonna matter. And I love that about it.
Yeah. Gordon, any final thoughts?
I said the two thoughtful things that I have to say about music.
But you nailed it. It's okay. On both of those. You really crushed it.
Yeah. Nice. It's okay. Just go back when you were in college and take music theory like for two or three semesters and mm-hmm. then come forward in time and tell us what you learned.
Okay, done.
Okay, how'd it go?
I learned that degrees in music don't ever apply except for in very, very specific cases.
Accurate. Correct. I work in a job where I have a graduate degree, and literally I could have grown up making homemade whistles under a bridge, and as long as I could make the shit, nobody cares. It doesn't matter what piece of paper you have. So, yep. Nailed it.
Well, thank you, Ryan, for coming on our final bonus episode of Dark Pages podcast.
Coming on your podcast to slag off all of higher education. Sorry about that. But
no, it was fun.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. I as I'm sure is the case with every guest you have, I love this fucking game and this fucking series and the way music
is. You're our only guest on this episode. Like, you're our only Dark Pages guest.
Ever?
All the other guests are Red Pages.
Oh, well, cool. Well, then I can only assume that I'm a much bigger fan of the series than anyone else you've had on the show, and they're all filthy casuals, yeah. Unlike
you're,
me.
You're top three, at least.
Sweet. I'll take it.
If people wanted to find your stuff, where would they go for that?
Oh, man. They would just Google my name. I'm Ryan Ike, RyanIke. I'm on Twitter as Ryan Ike Composer because I'm an idiot, and when I first got Twitter, I didn't know how it worked and that it doesn't matter if you are easily identifiable on there or not, so whoops, but that's where I'm at. You can also find me at my website, ryanike.com. And especially if you're listening and you are an unlikely listener who is trying to get into game audio, I love helping people get started. So please reach out to me and I will be happy to tell you why it's a bad idea, but help you do it anyway.
Well, what do we say to end this episode? Oh, we should thank our Patreon backers. Thank you, Patreon backers, for this, for backing us on Patreon and allowing us to continue making podcasts. This is the last one of these Dark Pages podcasts that you'll ever hear. And we appreciate
really?
You having let us make all of them.
Yeah, you guys are great.
Join us in Golden Pages podcast, our other podcast.
Yes. The successor podcast to this, Golden Pages podcast, is now available. If you go to our website at redpagespodcast.com, you can find it there. If you want to listen to us cover a game that is the polar opposite of Dark Souls.
It really is. Wow.
It sounds refreshing.
So, but you and this land are one.
Neither of us, none of the three of us want to see you go hollow.
Keep the sun always in your heart. I'm going to stop this recording.
The famous saying from the games.